not hers, given that she was known for the transformative role of the first lady, where she was more involved than any other first lady. So I do not deny her agency. I think she's culpable for all of the policies we discussed, whether it's shrinking the government, getting rid of welfare, allowing corporations to have more power to offshore jobs through NAFTA, the deregulation of Wall Street, which, by the way, deregulating derivatives occurred just a few months before her Senate campaign. She then received a lot of Wall Street donations. And then I also object to her record in the Senate, where she again would deregulate Wall Street and was actually more hawkish in her votes in terms of foreign policy than the Clinton administration, although I would disagree with his foreign policy as well. So overall, I'm very disappointed, and I plan to vote for Jill Stein because I believe New Mexico will win by double digits. However, if the race does seem close, unfortunately, I will have to vote for her, which is not something I'm happy about.
Josh Brody, I want to thank you for being with us. Sounds like a very interesting half hour you had when you went to have a meal at the Mexican restaurant in Santa Fe. I thank you for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy birthday to Angie Caron.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call our car donation experts at the Center for Car Donations to find out more information, ask questions, and support KBOO. Call 877-KBOO 123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our host, Abe Proctor. Today we'll ask, what is the best path back to a progressive America?
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the 29th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. This year, performers include Tedeschi Trucks Band, Dr. Joan and the Night Trippers, Maceo Parker, a Prince tribute with Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, and many, many more, plus two after-hours parties, dance competitions, six cruises, and 4th of July fireworks. This year, everyone will need a pass to enter the festival. Single-day passes go on sale June 1st, and early bird pricing has been extended to June 5th at 11:59 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, July 1st through 4th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
I got my headphones on just on the block. Not a moment to waste, because I feel the bass drop.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, to take place in locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence is an annual celebration of placemaking, community, natural building, music, and art. During the daytime, there will be 35 natural building and public arts projects to take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Happy Tuesday, the 31st of May, 2016. It's going to be beautiful and sunny and blue, the kind of day that Oregonians pine for months at a time when the skies are leaden and gray and oppressive and people turn to beer and other distractions to get them through the long winter. And then the day like this comes along and everyone complains about how hot it is. That is life in the Pacific Northwest, ladies and gentlemen. Fortunately, there is KBOO 90.7 FM to get you through it all, the cold and gray and the bright and sunny alike. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. Joe is not with us today. It's just me with you. I got a really broad agenda today. So hopefully we're going to keep the conversation moving along somewhat quickly. But I do need to set the table just a little bit at the outset. So if you want to take part in today's conversation, and I really encourage you to do so, you could do so over the phone at 503-231-8187. You can also leave comments in a couple different ways over the internet machine. First, at our Facebook page, that's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. And also on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. So those are your three vectors of communication, as it were. So what's on the docket for today? I want to talk about the post-war liberal consensus in the United States and how we as progressives, as liberals, as whatever label you choose to apply to yourself, left-leaning, radical, what have you, pinko commie, un-American hippies, whatever you want to call yourselves, how do we get back to something approximating that broad-based liberal post-war consensus? It's even a pre-war consensus, if we're being completely accurate. So what do I mean by that? Here's what I mean. Industrial capitalism, going back about 150 years, a little more than that right now, the Industrial Revolution, the most significant development to hit humanity since the agricultural revolution many thousands of years before. The Industrial Revolution came along in the mid-19th century, started in England, spread quickly to other parts of Europe and across the Atlantic to North America. Completely changed modes of production that had existed since the time human beings stopped being hunter-gatherers and started being farmers. This prompted a necessary and radical realignment in the way human beings not only produce the goods that sustain civilization, but in where and how and where they organize themselves. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the overwhelming majority of Americans, I'll just focus on the United States here for the most part because I think it's particularly informative in light of today's discussion. The vast majority of Americans prior to the Industrial Revolution lived rural lives. They were, by and large, the yeoman farmers that Thomas Jefferson envisioned when he saw the future of the American Republic stretching into the future. It's not an accident that I brought up Thomas Jefferson because among those many millions of Americans living agrarian lives were millions of dark-skinned Americans who were not, in fact, Americans in point of fact, who were owned by other Americans and forced to labor for those Americans' benefit. So bear that in mind. As I talk about the broad economic and social trends that accompanied the transition to industrialism, let's bear in mind that there was a very large class of Americans that were first enslaved, finally freed, and then systematically denied their full access to the American experiment for a long, long time, even to the present day. So that is one of the many subtexts running through this conversation. When I talk about the sweeping changes brought about by industrialism and industrial capitalism, let's not forget for one second that the benefits that accrued to those changes mostly accrued to the white portion of the American populace. So the Industrial Revolution comes along, rearranges the factors of production. Suddenly, we're able to produce agricultural goods at a rate that far exceeded what we were able to do in the past. Suddenly, you don't have to live and work on a farm all the time to make a living. In fact, suddenly people are surplus to the needs of the agricultural system in the United States. We don't need all these people to work the land anymore because we can do it in an automated fashion. Plus, the scientific breakthroughs that accompanied the Industrial Revolution further transformed the agricultural economy in the United States by drastically improving crop yields through the application of artificial fertilizers and automated and industrialized sowing and harvesting techniques and on and on and on. So what happened to all these people who used to be farmers? Well, they moved to the cities. As I mentioned, before the Industrial Revolution, the vast majority of Americans lived a rural and agrarian life, whether they were enslaved or not. After the Industrial Revolution and during, they began the great migration to urban centers. Now that today, that proportion is almost exactly inverted. The vast majority of Americans now live in urban centers. They do something, almost anything, except working the land as farmers. That perhaps is the most profound change wrought by the Industrial Revolution. So all these people move to cities. What do? They look for work. All of a sudden, you have to have something called a job. Jobs are a byproduct of the Industrial Revolution. Prior to that, if you're a human being, most of the time you were a farmer, or you were a hunter-gatherer, or you were some blend of the two. There are a few people who made a living as artisans, or as merchants, or as mercantile capitalists, traders, if you will. Still others made a living as members of the professional military class, but the vast majority of people worked the land, they produced food, they produced the raw materials necessary to sustain the rest of civilization. This changed radically, as I mentioned, during the Industrial Revolution. All of a sudden, you have to have a job. You are a body. You are a human being walking around. Plus, there's a whole bunch more now because the industrial, our capacity for agricultural production has increased so dramatically that now there are enough extra calories floating around the surface of the world to support a whole lot more people. So you really begin to see the exponential growth of human population accompanying the transition to an industrial economy. These two things parallel each other. So all these extra bodies are floating around. It's much harder to find work as a farmer anymore. Wealth is beginning to be concentrated in fewer and fewer hands because as the modes of production changed, as the capacity for production grew exponentially, so too grew the ability to concentrate wealth in the hands of the ownership class at a scale never before achieved, well, I should qualify that statement, at a scale rarely achieved in the history of human civilization before. Maybe the pharaohs of ancient Egypt approximated the concentration of wealth that we're talking about here. So all these factors are converging in this new industrial way of life, which is entirely new in the human experience. All of a sudden, you have to have a job. All of a sudden, you live in the city, you have to work for somebody. You earn a wage now. You earn money instead of being able to raise your own food and largely provide for yourself and for your family. This is, as I mentioned, a profound change in the human situation. So now, all of a sudden, the people who are offering jobs have a whole lot of say over how you live your life and in what fashion you're able to live your life because they provide your wages. They set your wages. And I need not go into too much detail, because I'm sure you've all heard it before, about the conditions that prevailed during the early stages of industrial capitalism. And they were not pretty. People worked in abysmal and dangerous and horrific conditions. People worked 12, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you were a Christian, for example, and you worked for a Christian, for example, you might be lucky enough to have 1 day a week off, if you were lucky. There was no such thing as paid sick leave. There was no such thing as paid vacation. There were very few holidays. And if you did have one, chances are you didn't get any money when you took that holiday. All of the cards were held by the ownership class in the early stages of industrial capitalism. So as you might imagine, this new arrangement gave vent to some of the baser instincts in the human animal, particularly in the ownership class. All of a sudden, you've got an economic system that is entirely animated by fear and greed. Now, you could argue that these things have animated the upper echelons of the economic strata throughout human history, and you'd probably be right. But again, the major difference, and I want this to really sink into your brains, the major difference between the industrial era and the pre-industrial era is one of scale. We always made things before the industrial era. We always grew crops before the industrial era. But now that industrialism and these dramatic changes in the modes of production have come along, you can now produce things, stuff, at a scale never before seen. And now you can concentrate wealth at a scale never before seen. And now the fear and greed that animates the ruling class can be expressed at a level never before seen. So what does this mean in practical terms? It means that the new industrial capitalist system, driven by a growing financial sector, is subject to the fear and greedy whims of the ownership class to a dramatic extent. Capitalism, in other words, is primed for cycles of boom and bust over and over and over again. And who bore the brunt of this excess? The poor and working classes. So that part of human history didn't change much with the onset of industrialism. But this finally got so bad that workers in the United States began to gather together and unite and to form unions and start to lobby on their own behalf. This was, in every possible expression of the concept, a necessary check and balance to the excesses of industrial capitalism. Quite simply, if you're going to have a healthy society, you cannot have big business without organized labor, or else your labor force will be subject to the worst possible set of conditions you can imagine, up to and including the labor of children. This is what industrial capitalism does when it is not regulated, when it is not reined in by things like a strong organized labor movement. It starts hiring children. It starts dumping things in rivers. It starts belching things into the air. It forces laborers to work in the most dangerous and toxic of conditions. All these things happen under capitalism when there is no oversight, when there is no strong labor movement to offset it. This is what happens. So American workers begin to organize, they begin to push back, they begin to finally claw back some of the ground and some of the autonomy lost during the transition from an agriculturally based society to an industrially based one. And they are surprisingly successful at this. But the boom and bust cycle of industrial capitalism goes on. We had a particularly bad bust at the end of the 1920s called the Great Depression. You may have heard of it. The conditions of the Great Depression, which came as the union movement was already in full swing. The deprivations of that era finally brought about what would become the post-war liberal consensus in the United States. What do I mean by that? I mean a number of things. I mean strong regulations on the ownership sector, on the producing side of industrial capitalism, to do a number of things. One, to provide safer working conditions for workers. Two, to provide better wages for workers. Three, to begin to provide some sort of security for workers in the form of health insurance, in the form of retirement insurance and pensions, and at a national level, in the creation of a retirement pension system, Social Security, that applies to every American. We didn't really need these things as much in the pre-industrial era. Was there a need for something like Social Security? Well, possibly you could argue that there was. But really, in a mostly agrarian society, when you grew old, when you could no longer take care of yourself, you had a strong family context in which to continue your existence. You got old, you couldn't work anymore. Your kids and your grandkids took care of you. And I'm generalizing here, but that's by and large how it was. But with the transition to an industrial economy, being old and being no longer able to work meant you didn't have any more wages. You didn't have this farmstead existence in which food was pulled out of the ground to sustain you anymore. We had an epidemic in this country of the elderly and the injured and the sick being completely destitute, being thrown to the whims of the market economy, which really, when it came down to it, really didn't give a damn about them. So we had the creation of Social Security as a direct response to the most dehumanizing elements of industrial capitalism. And during the post-war era, you saw the extension of this reimagined social contract. You saw the extension of this to things like Medicare, to things like Medicaid, to a series of incredibly robust, by today's standards, incredibly robust investments in things like national infrastructure, in things like transportation, in education, in higher education, in research and development, and on and on and on. This was the post-war liberal consensus. This was, we had hoped, industrial capitalism finally coming to its senses and realizing that it needed to muzzle itself for the betterment of all human beings. Now, this consensus held true for a number of decades after the Second World War. It began to unravel during the 1970s, and it really began to unravel with the establishment of a new, much farther right along the political spectrum, center of consensus as embodied by the Ronald Reagan administration, in which his explicit aims were to roll back the regulation of capitalism that had served people, working people, so well for so long, to cut taxes on the highest incomes, which had also served us so well for so long, and to completely abandon any semblance of fiscal discipline, and to borrow like a drunken sailor and spend it on the military. That's what happened under the new Reagan right of center consensus. And since then, progressives have been steadily losing ground, particularly economically. And that's really the focus that I'm talking about here. An economic, social and economic consensus. 503-231-8187 today. My question to you is, how do we get back to something like that post-war consensus? I'm not saying it was perfect. Take the GI Bill, for example, that put all those returning American soldiers through school. No, did I say all those soldiers? Not all of them. African-American soldiers, who by and large fought with incredible distinction during that war, could not avail themselves of the GI Bill. The same with the Veteran Administration loans that gave so many of those soldiers and their new families a house to live in. So this consensus that I'm talking about, however more equitably it may have shared the fruits of industrial capitalism, it still didn't reach everybody. It wasn't a utopia. And this is ironic too, because when you hear conservatives talk about returning to this golden era, this is what they're talking about. They're talking about the late 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. Maybe a utopia for straight Christian white guys, but not so much for everybody else. But nevertheless, when we look at this period, it is by far the most enlightened period since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in terms of equitably distributing the fruits of this new system of production. And it paid some dividends in other ways as well. I talked earlier about the massive, robust investment in education in the United States, particularly in higher education. This also created the conditions in which an unprecedented flowering, what's the right term I'm looking for? It created the conditions in which the civil rights movement and the voting rights movements could coalesce and become something real, something of substance. And I'm not trying to say to people of color that the great benevolent white society suddenly created these conditions so that your situation could improve. No, this was because of the hard work, sacrifice, dedication, focus, and moral clarity of the civil rights and voting rights movements that these things happened. But the post-war liberal consensus created, I believe, the fertile ground in which these movements could take root. So what the question today is, progressives, how do we get back to something like that? How do we get back to something like that, where the concentration of wealth is not so extreme as it is today? When we invest robustly in education, when we repair the infrastructure that is falling apart all around us, when we start investing in new infrastructure for things like wind energy and solar energy, and when do we start investing in things like a nationwide fiber optic communications network, all the hallmarks of an enlightened society that we so desperately need. How do we get back there? I'm interested to know what you think. 503-231-8187. Who's first? Steve, Sean, good morning.
Good morning, Abe. Thanks for hosting the show this morning.
What's on your mind?
I had a buddy who was studying economics up at Evergreen College many years ago, and he described our economic system as a system that shoots its wounded. And I couldn't help thinking of that when you were talking about the sick and the elderly before Social Security. But I guess in response to your question, though, for the morning, I'm going to say it and say it and keep saying it and keep saying it. But the number one problem we have is the petty bourgeois mentality. The petty bourgeois mentality. It's a small business mentality. It's a culture of the entrepreneur. It promotes an ethos of hierarchy, of individualism. And we need to get back to an ethos of solidarity. Do we want to create an egalitarian society? Do we think the best human and environmental outcomes come from an egalitarian society? If we do, we have to crush the petty bourgeois small business entrepreneurial mentality, which is hyper-individualistic and promotes hierarchy, and advance an ethos of solidarity. Now, how many times have you heard someone say, someone that you think is relatively progressive, they'll say to you something like, I don't want to be rich. I just want to be comfortable. Well,
yeah, I've heard that many times. I may have said it myself.
As far as I'm concerned, no offense to you personally.
I'm not offended.
But I find that to be just a grotesque, petty bourgeois mentality. Do we really want an egalitarian society? If we do, well, we can't pursue a life of highly educated professional success. I mean, we have to align ourselves with the people who live with an ethos of solidarity, and that's generally speaking non-college educated, working class, and poor people. So the number one problem we have is the petty bourgeois mentality. We'll never get to the kind of progressive outcomes you're talking about until we crush the petty bourgeois mentality.
That's a very interesting take, and I have to admit, one I didn't expect to hear right off the bat here.
Cool.
So, yeah, that's good. So let me ask you this, though. All right, we talked about a more egalitarian, solidarity-based economic system that favors the poor and working classes. So in this situation that you're envisioning, where do the poor and working classes work?
Well,
how does that work?
As it stands right now, I think the economist Richard Wolff has made an excellent argument, is we have a problem of leverage. We're no longer needed as workers. We're no longer needed as consumers. The only possible point of leverage that I can see for poor and working class people is some sort of general strike. People working at Walmart, when there's no enforcement of labor laws, where's the point of leverage? If Donald Trump, who is a crony capitalist goon, and Hillary Clinton, who is also a crony capitalist, is that my
yeah,
timer?
Yeah, but please continue. I'm exercising executive fiat this morning.
Okay.
Continue.
Well, these two crony capitalist goons are not going to enforce labor laws. Then how do poor and working class people exercise leverage within the bounds of the law? As long as Taft-Hartley is on the books, making general strikes illegal, the only point of leverage for the poor and the working class is some sort of mass general strike where we just shut the society down. I don't know where else does our leverage come from?
Now, I want to follow up on a couple points here. I agree with you that a general strike, I think, will be in the future of the United States at some point. It's just a question of when. You're right that it's our only remaining lever to apply to the inequities inherent in this system. But I want to push back a little bit on the system you're describing. Where I live in Portland, I can walk a few blocks. I can walk 5-10 minutes, and all of a sudden I'm in a little area where there's an independent bookstore. There's a nice pub that I like to go into for a pint. There is a organic grocery store. All these things. These are all small businesses. These are all owned by people invested in the welfare of their community. Now, it sounds as if you're suggesting this is an inherently bad arrangement. But I go into these places and I talk with these people, and I don't see the rapacious, petty bourgeois mentality that you're talking about.
Well, I can only speak, for myself personally, but let's just take, an average person, say, graduating from high school. They look out across the landscape of America, across the landscape of the world. They say to themselves, hey, what's going on with the economy? Hey, what's going on with foreign policy? Hey, what's going on with the environment? Now, is the appropriate action to take to say, I think the way I'm going to deal with this situation is I'm going to start a small business. That's really going to address what's going on with the world and with the planet and with our god-awful foreign policy. For myself, starting a small business is the last thing people should be doing. So that's just my personal take on it.
Very interesting. And I, like I said, not what I expected to hear. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. We are talking about the post-war liberal consensus in the United States and what we as progressives can do to get ourselves back to something approximating it, hopefully with a more truly inclusive set of circumstances. One in which, for example, people of color aren't forced to use separate bathrooms and drinking fountains. That just being one example. So please give us a call, 503-231-8187. You can also leave us a note at the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, or on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Who's next, Steve? Leslie, good morning.
Hi. First, I quickly wanted to address a call that I know you're going to get about how American capitalism created all the wealth that made it possible to have the 40-hour week and to have the lifestyle we enjoy. Well, another way that we got that was outsourcing the injustice and the economic suffering to other places, to Latin America, to Asia, to Africa, that those were the places that were turned into the sources of the raw product used to create capitalism.
You're so correct.
So that was where the suffering went.
You're so right. I'm really glad you brought that up.
And one other quick point. I wanted to briefly talk about the disgustingly hypocritical and cynical trip of Obama to Hiroshima. Talking about where we can get the money to turn this around, the Obama administration is proposing a $1 trillion upgrade in our nuclear weapons system. So if you're wondering where the money is going that's not being spent on infrastructure, not being spent on healthcare, not being spent on education, not being spent on the environment, you want to know where all that money is going, and while they're talking about waste and graft, that money is being spent in upgrading America's nuclear weapons systems.
Yeah, that is an unfortunate truth, isn't it?
Yep.
I don't know if it accounts for all that money, but it accounts for a substantial
chunk. Well, it's $1 trillion, and as far as I know, $1 trillion is a twelfth of the cost of the U.S. economy, so that is a pretty huge chunk.
It looks like fear and greed are still pretty firmly in charge, aren't they?
Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, take care.
All right, the caller brought up such an important point here. So the ownership class, as I mentioned, during the early days of industrial capitalism, didn't give a damn about the working class. This is not a matter of opinion. This is established fact. You need only do a very small amount of research about working conditions prior to the advent of government regulation to find out what I'm talking about is true. We're talking about abysmal, horrible, dangerous, life-shortening conditions. Horrible, abysmal, life-shortening work hours. None of the things that we take for granted today. For example, weekends. What is a weekend? Well, it didn't exist in early industrial capitalism. So ever since the labor movement, by literally kicking and clawing, it's scratching its way to some sort of position of power. I'm talking about people dying to advance the cause of workers. The ownership class has been looking for ways to recapture its lost gains ever since then. And as the caller mentioned, one of the ways, perhaps the most profound and lasting way in which the ownership class has done this, is by sending capital around the world looking for cheaper labor. I actually had an argument with somebody not too long ago, a pro-capitalist, who shrugged his shoulders and said, well, American labor simply priced itself out of the market. Priced itself out of the market. What is the subtext there? If only workers had known their place, it's because they had the temerity to seek higher wages and better working conditions and time to enrich themselves and their families as human beings. If only they had just known their place and not tried to get these things, because it just forced capitalists to go elsewhere where labor is cheap, regulations are weak or non-existent, because, well, American workers, they just asked for too much. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions about whether or not that position is un-American. 503-231-8187. Pear, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Abe.
Good morning.
Good. Beautiful day out.
It is.
You know, I'm thinking that, you know, this industrial base that you're talking about may not be around forever either. It depends on cheap energy, and it depends on perpetual growth.
That's true.
Those are very much in question. So what I'm saying is that the future, we may be, the cities may be kind of emptying out, especially in other parts of the world, and we may be going back to some kind of an agricultural economy, and it doesn't have to be like the one we used to have. You know, hopefully it'll be better, but I'm just saying that the sort of perpetual growth is very much in doubt. And so if we want to have a progressive economy, it'll be sort of in a new situation.
Hmm. Interesting. So you're talking about a conscious reappropriation of some of that agrarian lifestyle that industrialism killed.
Yeah, there's different ways of doing it. I think in one way or another, there'll be more people working on the land. Now, they can do it, you know, the way our system is going. It probably means more prison farms and plantations and things. But it doesn't have to be that way, you know.
Right.
We could have, maybe people should check out the Zapatistas and the peasant movements in Latin America. You know, this may be they may be showing us the way to the future.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
Anyway, so I toss that in. Everything else, as far as progressive values goes, yes, we do need those. In fact, if we have a kind of an economic downturn because of the lack of growth, we're going to need these progressive measures more than ever.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Anyway, so I toss that in there.
Hey, thanks, Pear. Appreciate it. I just love the colors on this show. I mean, these are such salient points we're raising right now. Pear noted just now that the expansion of industrial capitalism has depended almost entirely on the ready availability of very cheap combustible energy that's not going to last forever. And the problem is, this is such a complex picture. It's really hard to encapsulate it and then thoroughly discuss it in the course of an hour. But I submit we're making some headway today. It's an incredibly complex system, global capitalism. It's one that's predicated on endless growth. Capitalism has to get bigger every single year, or it doesn't work. But what happens when you have an economic system predicated on endless growth, which exists in a closed biosphere? That is a recipe for disaster, and we are bumping up against that now. We are seeing what happens when industrial capitalism starts bumping up against the limits of this little gas-covered sphere on which we live. Something's going to have to give. And if fear and greed continue to have their sway, it's not going to be capitalism that gives. It's going to be polar ice caps. It's going to be global average temperature. It's going to be environmental disasters one after another. It's going to be increasing shortages of food and especially water. It's going to be massed forced migrations of people away from coastal regions as sea levels rise. This is what happens when endless growth meets the limits of a closed biosphere. And we are only beginning to think our way out of this conundrum. And the clock is ticking. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Thomas, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Abe. It's a very stimulating conversation indeed. And I like the heading, the big question about bringing America back to progressive values. And, you know, let's turn it on its ear. I would say this. America, depending on what you mean by the word America, if we meet America, the political institutions and the policies, America is not progressive. If we mean the actually well-known and well-polled opinions of the great majority of Americans going back all the way before 1980 and all the way through this so-called right-wing revolution in American politics, it's been pretty much a standard and consistent. And there's been many analysts and writers who have pointed this out, including Noam Chomsky, that that indeed there's a huge disconnect between the known values of the great majority of the American populace on every single major policy issue, be it domestic economics and health care, retirement, Social Security, or foreign policy, with the exception of a few times when we get whipped up into a jingoistic froth over things like weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
The American public is pretty absolutely consistent, but there's this complete disconnect between that's indeed, I would posit, as a manufactured disconnect. We've been in this complete death spiral of lesser of the evils voting. And really, this ties into what your first caller says. Your first caller mentioned, I think, a few very important points. One, the fact that we're almost to the point of needing to have things like they're having in France, when they have had much of the rest of the civilized world forever, which is, essentially things analogous to general strikes and organized action. And the other thing he was talking about, the using a little bit maybe quaint language, talking about the petty bourgeois mentality. But that's true, and I think that shows today in the rift in the Democratic voters, the rift between the people that are older than 45 and younger than 45. You go older than 45, mm-hmm. you have a huge group of people who are really, by and large, with exceptions, there is elderly poverty in America. We don't like to talk about it. But generally, you have the last group of Americans who maybe benefited from the GI Bill. Their parents got them through school in the GI Bill, or they had almost no college debt, and they maybe have their retirement and their 401k. And so there's a very, very entrenched go along to get along. I'm going to go and do my voting, and I don't want to do anything else. And then there's the young people, which is pretty much anyone under 45 who knows that that's all been systematically dismantled by the people that are supposed to represent them in the Democratic Party. And I think, and now we're at a point where, indeed, I think the young people are realizing that it's not about, this cultural meme or this of the Democratic Party being influenced by the outside, but that it's occupied, and that indeed the Clinton and the Clinton faction and those are internal malefactors who actually control a party. And the only thing they're left to do is to get in and have the very thing that the older Dems don't want to do, have an internal struggle, a real fight. Stop bringing slingshots to a gunfight and can take back control of the Democratic Party, and that's the only way it's going to happen. Otherwise, we can continue doing this till the cows come home and voting in all of the people, the type A's and the alpha establishmentarians like the Clintons that are just going to keep changing their rhetoric whenever convenient and go right back to giving their money or giving their power to the people that continue to divide us. So that's my two cents.
I think you're so right. I don't understand people who think that the argument going on in the Democratic Party is anything but a good thing. It's a great thing, and it's long overdue. And I, for one, am happy to see it.
Yeah, the call for class unity is a canard. It's exactly the opposite of what needs to happen. And fortunately now, the powers that be that have learned that have to occupy the core of the Democratic Party, who've learned to game the system and use the same kind of dirty tricks as Republicans do. I ask you to look at what happened in the Nevada primary just most recently. Mm-hmm. They're sweating because now they see the power of individual online donations for people to build a countervailing force against the establishmentarians in the party. And also they see the possibility of people organizing, giving the new online tools too. So this really, I think, is the 11th hour of the neocons and the Hillary Clinton conservatives controlling the Reagan Democrats, if you will, controlling the party. I think this is the turning point right now. If we make it be the turning point,
I couldn't agree more. And that was an excellent call, sir. Thank you. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. David writes into the Twitter machine to say, progressives are too splintered. Perhaps a crisis will rally and focus them. Afraid to speculate what that might be. President Trump? Question mark. And Revolution Livestream also writes into Twitter. That's at HonestAbe72. Writes to say, the Verizon strike that was just settled, which largely included workers' rights and restricting ability for Verizon to outsource jobs. Yes, those are the sorts of resolutions we need to these kinds of disputes. And as I said earlier in this program, I believe that a general strike lies somewhere in America's future. Probably not too far into America's future. 503-231-8187. Who's next, Steve? Mitch, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Abe, and I want to thank you because your analysis at the top of the show was so simple and clear in language that's understandable that
thank
I
you.
Plan on forwarding the link of the audio archive to my media discussion list.
Hey, thank you, sir.
And I also think that every caller we've had so far, it's an incredible batting average. You're batting 1,000 with every caller here because they each point out facets. There is no one, you know, overarching theory that's going to account for how the contradictions in every ideology across the spectrum, right to left, when those internal contradictions are not addressed or dealt with honestly and in the open, they come and they sink each dogma. And whether you're a free trader, not dealing with the contradictions that there's no such thing as an unrigged free market because there are too many factors that will ever allow for that laboratory condition, or whether you're talking anywhere on the spectrum. This is why I think that the people who use the terms nowadays in online social blogs about news and events, they are falling into a divide and conquer trap because the terms liberal and conservative, it all depends on who you're standing next to when you define yourself as one, and it depends at what period of time. And I think that the only thing I would add to your discussion here is a consideration of two words that are in fact also a misleading label, social contract. Everywhere across the world, as wealth concentrates into smaller and fewer hands, the term social contract, it becomes more and more abstract and remote. But it was never an unwritten contract. It's just that Americans are not engaged enough in things like, how did we get to lower our tariffs and trade barriers? Well, they went up in the first place to make our internal markets the envy of the world because of a social contract, because we didn't want our workers to compete with slave labor around the world.
Right. It was a priority.
And I would just recommend that for those of us who consider ourselves on the left, the liberal, the progressive, whatever word you use, you will be shocked to talk to hard right-wingers and libertarians who would vote for Bernie Sanders before they would vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, not because they agree with Bernie Sanders' democratic socialism, they'll still demonize him, but they will honestly say he's more straightforward and honest about where he's coming from. And I would suggest all of us on the left and the progressive liberal end read Thomas Frank's current book, Listen Liberal, because Listen Liberal goes after the high-tech crowd that created this neoliberal economic model across the world that even conservatives tend to vote for, like the Obama trade deals, that further concentrate wealth in fewer hands. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. God, what a great call. God, there's so much there. I wish this show was going on 3 or 4 hours today. There's so much there. What that call points to quite prominently in my mind is the shortcoming of the bifurcated, bipolar, two-party system in this country that tends to frame every argument, every issue, as if there are only two possible solutions to it, or as if there are only two possible paths forward. This is incredibly reductive and incredibly destructive. At a time in human history when we so desperately need a diversity of human opinion and a human perspective to find a way out of the corner we've painted ourselves into, we rely on this polarized, silly system of debate in this nation where you're either on one side or you're on the other of every single issue. Now, how, as a caller pointed out, how do you possibly reconcile internal conflicts within a given ideology or even a set of ideologies? The answer is you don't. The answer is you eventually get to a situation where we are now, where the entire decision-making system has been purchased and both sides simply butt heads with each other, and only incremental progress is made at the margins of our society. this is unacceptable. This is unsustainable. This is going to drown the world. Literally drown the world. 503-231-8187. Who's next, Steve? Frank, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, there's a couple of things I'd like to point out. I was born and raised in Detroit, and if you look at Detroit today, I would say Detroit is a bellwether for this country. And what I mean is that basically, if you look at the city of Detroit, extreme poverty, and you have two core areas. You have the surrounding suburbs where people who are well-to-do maintain their lifestyle, and then wealthy people have taken over the downtown area, revitalized it, but it's almost, an area that the poor people really don't have access to. And what I see happening in this country is that rather, with this contraction of social programs and stuff, we're having more and more people being abandoned and, for economic reasons. Another classic example is San Francisco, where rents and everything have got and property values have gone so high that basically the middle and the poorer class cannot exist within the city of San Francisco. And so what you have is you have this displacement of people where people that are of high means are displacing, pushing out people, and and these people have no place to go. And this is also coupled with the problem that there really are no jobs in which people can really pick themselves up with by the bootstraps. And by that I mean a lot of the jobs, and this is classic in Detroit, have been replaced by robotics. Adidas opened a factory in Germany to manufacture shoes totally by robotics. Well, granted, you don't have the low-cost workers in Asia making your shoes. You have robots making them. But what happens to those people now that have lost even that minimal income? And so what we have is that we have a political system that is saying we need to cut back on the social safety net and tax people less and all this sort of thing, protect the wealth of the extremely wealthy, when our need is the total opposite. We need to expand our social safety net because more and more people are being economically displaced by the changes that are happening within our country.
Wow, that was another great call. Thank you very much, sir. I mean,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, did you want to finish up?
No, I'm done. I mean, that's my point. I mean, we have some dramatic economic changes that have been taking place throughout the world, which are displacing people. And we have a dangerous situation that says where the laborer is of no value, okay? And therefore, these people are of no value. And so we don't do anything out of any sense of social consciousness to help people.
Exactly. Where is the emphasis on human dignity? Where is the value on wealth created through work instead of through ownership? You're absolutely right.
Exactly. And it's kind of a scary thing. I think we're getting large segments of our population that are, are totally disposable. Nobody, and we as a society and our political system refuse to adjust to a need that's reflected by the changes in things.
I think you're absolutely right, and thank you so much for the call. It's a recipe for revolution is what it is. Susan writes into the Facebook page to say, thank you for a most interesting discussion. As a female, I'd like to ask, what were the forces that have allowed me to achieve educationally and personally? In my mother's time, women couldn't even vote. Certainly a progressive agenda at some point during my lifetime was largely responsible for what I have been able to achieve when contrasted with many millions of women elsewhere on the planet. My question, could capitalism have helped me or hindered me in my particular life journey? I think the answer to that is capitalism has both helped you and hindered you in your particular life journey. Now, we spend most of a show decrying industrial capitalism and what it has done to the social order and to the environmental situation of the planet. But it is also true that under industrial capitalism, particularly in the developed nations, lifespans have lengthened. Infant mortality has gone down. We have eliminated a number of diseases that have plagued humans throughout our history. The list of real and concrete achievements and progress that have benefited and elevated the human condition under capitalism are many, and they should not be ignored in this conversation. The problem is, as we have spent much of this hour talking about, is the fallout on the environment, on the social order, on human dignity, on the value of work, on the ability of human beings to live their lives in such a way as to explore what it means to be fully human. That is one of the reasons we are on this planet, to find out what it means to be fully human. And unrestricted, unfettered industrial capitalism grinds that into the dust. But it has also given us some miraculous things, and we should not overlook that in this conversation. 503-231. Oh, so to finish answering Susan's question, I think that it has more been the progressive movements that have pushed back against the excesses of capitalism that have created the social space in which you and millions of other women have taken substantial steps towards an equal playing field with men. Granted, there's a long way to go. We are pretty far from equal at this point, but I don't think anyone can argue that things aren't a hell of a lot better now in the developed nations than they used to be. Ironically, some of that social space was carved out as a result of the two big world-scale military conflicts of the industrial age. I'm talking about the First and Second World Wars, which were really one long world war, but that's a discussion for another time. Wars, especially large-scale ones, have a way of rejiggering the social order and bringing about an accelerating change that might otherwise have taken a long time to take place. Look at how many women, for example, went to work during the Second World War and started doing things that had always been in the traditional sphere of men. Look at all the women who started undergoing advanced education and training during the Second World War because so many men were off fighting. These events also, and I'm not trying to justify either of these wars, don't get me wrong, these events created the social space in which these changes could happen. And when the changes, these sorts of changes, are backed by a strong wind of progressive policy and progressive change, then good things are going to happen. And good things did happen. And the question I'm posing to listeners today, and one I think we've gone a great distance toward answering, is how do we get that wind blowing again, so that we all move forward and we begin to get ourselves out of this conundrum into which we've placed ourselves. Pardon my stilted syntax. 503-231-8187. John, it's going to have to be fast. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Abe. So a little while back, you guys did a Slouching Towards Bethlehem episode. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of more lines from that poem by W.B. Yeats. Mm-hmm.
Love that poem.
Yes, it's a very profound poem. And one of the lines says, the center will not hold. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is that the best lack all conviction and the worst are filled with passionate intensity. I think that the real thing, that applies now, that the best lack all conviction and the worst are filled with passionate intensity. People know what's wrong, but I think people of just basic, decent nature are disempowered, frustrated, and just simply trying to survive and not crumble into despair. And it's hard to motivate, to do exactly the kind of things that we've been talking about, which is what do we do for the general good? And I really agree with Ralph Nader. He talks about a left-right alliance, and you had a caller who mentioned the same kind of thing. And that really does exist, and we've been separated from each other through identity politics, through all of the things where we separate our basic humanity, where we think of each other as the other rather than the us. And if we could find a way to build bridges so that we see ourselves in a common way, that would be hugely beneficial.
Sir, that was magnificent, and I think a wonderful way to end today's show. Great call. Great calls from everybody today. I could go right on doing this, y'all. This has been a whole lot of fun, and I really appreciate everybody's contributions. The homework assignment this week, I want you to keep thinking on this topic, because it's one that we're going to keep revisiting on this show, because in many ways, it represents the central human conundrum at this point in time. This is KBOO 90.7. I'm Abe Proctor. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program. We'll be back at you next week.
It's coming through a crack in the wall on a visionary flood of alcohol from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. It's a minute after 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this